All right. Politicking with y'all today. We're going to have a candid conversation about being a first generation student, finances, maneuvering the space of adulthood, and all of the good, the bad, and the ugly things that we've learned. Today, I have a very special guest. For those of you who tuned in earlier into the pandemic, we had Dr. Bell tap in with us and have a candid conversation on what it means to be a Black body in the midst of this pandemic. Today, we're bringing Dr. Bell back because not only is he a dear friend, a dear brother to me, someone who is extremely inspirational, I feel like there is no better person to have this conversation with about what it means to survive. Living to survive versus living to thrive versus existing as a first generation and really trying to meet those dreams that we desire in the fucking whack ass place called adulting. Like, adulting, adulthood, the ghetto-ness of it, the ghetto-ness of 2020. We just about to tap, tap, tap in. Hate that fucking song. It's not my favorite song of Sweetie, but
no, let's talk about how those Freaknik hairstyles are coming back, and I'm low-key excited.
You excited? I was looking like, if it wasn't for COVID-19, it would really be lit in the club.
I am living because like that is like my low-key like spirit, like I'm not a spirit animal, but like that's like a major part of like my childhood, right? It's like seeing a bunch of Black women with these exaggerated hairstyles,
yes,
and like these exaggerated fingernails, like these big bamboo earrings that were real gold. You know, like, these big bamboo earrings, a nose piercing, and just like all that Black girl magic, raising children, you know, making us, like, taking us to cookouts and gatherings and the PTA meetings, you know? So I'm excited to see that Black women are now re-embracing those hairstyles again, because I think that they're the epitome of Black culture. That's Black American culture.
Period. Oh, ooh, you said a word real quick. You remember the movie that Jada Pinkett Smith played in, Jason's Lyric?
Oh, yep.
And old girl, her friend with the ah.
Oh, girl, the hair juice.
Yes.
Everything, like.
You can't wipe your finger without the curve in the nail. What you wiping for? Them shit's not long enough, baby.
Girl, they gotta be a little bit longer.
A little bit longer.
they ain't never long enough. They can always be a little bit longer.
You know what? Speaking of these nails, my mother told me that back in the day, she was like, yeah, Coco, them used to be her real nails. And I'm like, why is this like the longest lasting... I don't want to say lie, because you know how Black mothers get. You called me a lie. But, like, I just felt like it was not true. Those were not her nails. Like, she had to get them shits done. Them ain't real. Her real nails curved like that.
Girl, you'd be surprised that, like, some people are able to grow nails that long.
Some. But I don't think it was Coco. Like, Guinness Book of World Records curved nail is very different from what she was giving.
Okay, I can see like you know, right? Like, okay, like, so selling an image, selling an identity, right? So you want to like exaggerate your features because it makes you stand out. So, so I could definitely see that being a possibility. But then there's also the possibility that what if those were her real nails?
I need to Google this and
that needs to be known, because I need to keep my Black heart.
You're not about to take mine over Coco's nails.
The Black heart can definitely be revoked over the Coco nail.
Coco's nails were okay. First of all, there is a video of Coco SWV Talks Males, and Coco from SWV Long Fingernails Complications. So we will watch those after the podcast to confirm whether or not those nails were real. And I actually like long nails, and I could go a little bit longer, but
girl,
they will
girl,
break.
But I used to have nails, girl, and like the last time I had nails, I got into a scruffle.
Ooh.
I got into a little scruffle.
Ooh.
And girl, like those nails, girl, broke off in every angle but the right angle. And since then, I was like, no, baby. Oh, no, baby. I cannot have my nails around here bleeding like this. Never did it since.
So I'm going to tell you the truth, all right? Back in the day, I got into a little scruffle too, but they wasn't with acrylic nails.
not pop ones.
Oh, they was pop ones because I was going through it and I was a poor black kid just trying to, you know, do what I needed to do. And I was in 9th grade and I fought a 8th grader. Because she was trying to come for my shoes, and I was tired of people talking ish about me. It was really bad. And yeah, them nails was gone, baby.
So if only you had a credit card then to be able to you know to walk into a nail you know like to see a nail tech and get you your nails done the right way, or if you had a skill then you know to go to make your own nails or well in your case it was your shoes, but if you had a credit card to go and get some better quality shoes, then that might not have been the situation at that point in time.
But you know the thing about being in the 9th grade is I don't even think did I turn 16? I think I turned 16 in that summer, right? Because 8th grade
14. You should have been 14. So you should have been like 15.
You're right. No. Because I'm a baby, right? And so I always turned late in comparison to everybody else, and my numbers are fucked up. So, right.
You were 14?
Yes, because I turned 15 that summer. If I'm getting it right.
You graduated when you were 17?
Yes, and I turned 18 in EFIEL. Can you believe that?
I cannot stand who graduated when they were 17. Like, Because I knew that I would graduate when I was 18. I was like, I'm going to be 18. And there was, like, always, like, this small handful of the kids, like, I'm going to be 17. So they was trying to, like, kind of rub it in. Like, they're graduating younger. I'm like, please.
None of that mattered. If you wasn't 16 graduating younger, 17, 18 is a typical age. It was nothing to be insecure about. But moving along to what you were saying, the credit card. Like, for me, even if I did have the credit card, it wouldn't even be no... It ain't no money, you know, like, even if it, like, it's not real money. So me getting a credit card to not get drilled would have put me into more financial distress, you know? And I think also, like, the reality is we was all kids living in poverty. None of us, our parents, had it like that anyway, especially when you was going to Marshall, like, in the middle of the hood, in poverty, you know? So a lot of us tie our worth to materialistic shit, but everything comes full circle because during the pandemic, motherfuckers was coming out with their own press-on lines and, you know, going to CVS and Walgreens to get press-ons. And I have a couple press-on myself, but right now I have on my acrylics from a black-owned nail tech.
You know, and you want to know what, like, on top of that, like something that I've been seeing that has brought me so much joy is that I've been seeing men, black men specifically, like embrace their desires, you know, as nail tags and their talent, like, as nail tags. For example, there's a guy from Rochester named Dimitri. He now is a nail tag in Las Vegas. So if you're ever in the Vegas area, hit up my boy Dimitri.
Spell it out.
His name of his shop. I believe it's D as in dog, I, M I T R I. T-R-I. Yeah, T-R-I. I'm not sure where his establishment is, or like, or the name of the restaurant, of the nail salon that he's working in, but I'm sure we can, like, find it and
we
tag it.
We can find it and tag it. Boom. Done.
The video somewhere. But I say that because that's so dope that, you know, like, 2020 has brought, has shed light on so much of the, you know, hidden talents that are in our communities that usually doesn't get the attention that it deserves because of the more traditional communities that kind of take on that credibility, so to speak. But I wouldn't say credibility, but takes on that, for lack of a better word, so I can't think of the words today. Obviously, like, Asian, like, predominantly Asian communities take, you know, the rap for kind of doing nails. But the fact of the matter that there's tons of Black techs who are out here slaying the game. Mm-hmm. And they, too, deserve to be placed on a pedestal.
Talk about it.
You know?
You know what? That leads me into our politicking today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to end up pausing this section right now because this is the part that's going to be chopped out because we have 11 minutes of like chopping it up with each other to catch up. And so we'll tap into the politicking segment where we're actually talking about the conversation.
Okay.
Piggying back off of the conversation that we had prior, we talked a lot about being in poverty and, you know, kikiing over real shit and Black culture. But, you know, on a more serious note, I think it's important to reiterate the conversation about poverty and just maneuvering certain spaces in school, knowing that students in the middle of the pandemic will be returning back to college in the fall, and many of them may be their first time in college or they may be continuing their journey as first generation students. So for you, Dr. Bell, I want to ask you to define what a first generation student is. Talk about some of the experiences that first generation students have and how has that changed in the pandemic?
Okay, thank you so much, Charlita. Well, in my opinion, a first-generation student is someone who was the first in their family to pursue and, I want to say, complete higher education. So as obtaining a college degree of some sort, rather that's from a community college or from a university, or to go on and to pursue their master's degrees or their doctorate degrees. And so, again, to just reiterate that, a first-generation student is someone who's the first in their family to have attended and thus completed higher education. But I'm sure that can be arguably argued, depending on, like, whose opinion that is about whether even completed to be considered a first-generation student. For an alum, you would definitely have to have completed your studies. But to answer the second part of your question, some of the experiences that being a first-generation student, one can expect to experience, at least what I've experienced as a first-generation student, was feelings of inadequacy. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, so feelings of inadequacy vary, right? So it affects, like, how you see yourself amongst your classmates, your peers. Like, do you feel like you're like, that you belong in the space? Do you feel even prepared and nurtured and just well balanced to even occupy the spaces that you're currently in? So as a first generation student, there will be times where you will not have enough money to afford food.
Mm-hmm.
Where you will not probably have the best threads on as some of your classmates. You may still even be walking in or busing while many of your classmates are driving nice modern cars, some driving, luxury cars.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll also have to deal with the racial injustices that stem from being from a different socioeconomic status or a lower socioeconomic status. Mm. And that can encompass like being ostracized or so not being invited to certain gatherings, certain retreats, certain parties that may be ongoing with your campus community. And one example, I know, like for me, there was times when I was doing research for an institution, and being a first generation student involved in, you know, for the very first time in biological research at a four-year, you know, institution, this was like foreign to me. Like, I didn't know what was going on. Like, I didn't know what questions to ask. I didn't know what to look for. But everybody else knew what to look for in me, which was like very weird to me. Like, everyone else knew what to look for when assessing if I was the exception or even if I belonged in this, you know, in that space. And I say, and so with being a first generation student, you will experience those moments where other people will try to determine and assess your worthiness at the basis of your financial ability. And is it fair? Mm-mm. Heck nah. Like, is it right? No. But like, that's like part of the fiber of the American country, of capitalism, right? It's like, what do you have that can be used to exploit others? And if you're wealthy, then you can exploit many. But if you're poor, then you're the one who's being exploited. So I feel that paralleling that to what's happening now with the 2020 pandemic, mm-hmm. Being first generation definitely involves taking a lot of subtle losses. There's things that you just can't benefit from. There's things that you do not have any say in. For example, there's a lot of talk amongst the higher ed community about what social distancing policies will be in place come this fall semester. And one of those are dormitory living, right? Like, how will you live in your dorm room? And an example of that, I want to say, is at a college in the South. I don't want to say the institution because I may get it wrong. I don't quite remember the name of the institution. But pictures just surfaced on social media the other day in which this college had social distancing. I'm going to put those in quotations. Mm-hmm. Social distancing enacted in student dorms. And the social distancing consisted of PVC piping with a piece of fabric, you know, like wrapped around it, separating both sides of the dorm room. Now, if anyone who's been paying attention to the media, paying attention to the CDC, Dr. Fauci, or who is knowledgeable of viruses or just microbiology and immunology and virology as a whole, we know that the COVID-19 virus can be spread through the air, right? Through coughing, through breathing. That's why they're mandating for us to wear masks, right? So by seeing this school implement this policy of just a simple PVC piping and a piece of fabric, mm-hmm. to me, was problematic because that will undoubtedly impact poorer students,
right,
who are most likely first generation. So these first generation students don't have access to usually off campus housing. Their parents more likely cannot afford to get them an apartment off campus for $1,200, $1,300 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Right? it is not affordable. It's not ideal. So these students have to live on campus, in which these social distancing practices are not safe. So now these students face the risk of becoming infected, potentially getting terribly sick. And once they're sick, no telling what this will do to their like academic abilities or even their health as a whole. And so like that's just one of the many things that could result from being first gen and having to deal with the 2020 pandemic.
Such a word. And
such a word.
There, I'm so glad you said that, because in looking at the pandemic, I know with us off record, we've had conversations with each other about just being able to survive this pandemic and emotions that resurfaced that made us understand, like, damn, I felt this 3-4 years ago when I was in college trying to survive. Because my biggest fear was not being able to have the support that I needed for myself, having the generational stability that, quote unquote, is supposed to exist through this journey called college. And here we are on the other end, alum of a top-notch university, and having this conversation about how our degrees didn't save us as first-generation students from feeling the impact of COVID in our communities and with our families. It didn't give us a million-dollar job where we were able to resolve all the issues that exist within our family, because money is not going to resolve systemic conditions that have existed for years. It's just, it's not the only solution. We need money on money on money on money on money. Not just money. Not just money. So for those of you who's like, I don't know where you're going with this. No, not this one, baby. Not this one. But it's very true. It's like, we need money and then some. We need support and then some. This COVID-19 pandemic has really brought to the forefront more conversations about, like, all right, well, why did we wait till COVID to figure out that people need affordable housing, that the poor can't social distance properly, that many of the poor live in high dense communities. Many of the poor work in low wage jobs. Like, let's talk about this. So it's a triple down effect. And that experience, on top of what it means to be first gen and show up, can kill your spirits. And it can make you question why you decide to go to college in the first place. About 3 years ago, there was a study that examined first generation students go to college in order to help their families. And 69% of first generation students surveyed say that they went to college because they want to help their family, in comparison to 39% of students whose parents have already earned a degree. The desire also extends to the community, with 61% of first-generation students wanting to give back to their communities versus 43% in comparison to their peers. How do you feel about that?
I'm curious to know, like, where that stands now. Like, of those percentages of students who enrolled in college to help their families, how many of them have been able to help their families now? Mm-hmm. How many of them are employed? In light of the 2020 pandemic, how many of them are still employed? Or are awaiting a stimulus, you know, aid from the government? I'm just so curious to know if that data is going to be taken anytime soon. I would certainly hope so, because that sheds more light on the reason and the need of having just money poured into these communities, because there's something not working. Something is not leading.
Racism.
Simply put, right? Racism and a whole host of other factors are preventing you know, the upward plight of this population of people who are trying to evoke change.
Very
it's
funny.
really alarming, because like I for one am one of those individuals who went to college, you mm-hmm. know, with the goals to help my family, mm-hmm. And to help my community, right. Being a part of the Black queer community, I've seen it like unfold like numerous of times. You know, premature mortality from mm-hmm. you know poverty stricken ailments such as, you know, drug abuse leading to overdoses, or sex work leading to infectious diseases that are terminal and chronic, as well as just like high violence and all that as a result of, you know, the inability to afford the thing that one needs, you know, to just get by. And so just seeing how, like, still having dreams and goals, how they can be undermined just simply because of, like, your class status or your born socioeconomic status or the status that the socioeconomic status that you were born into. So it's just like raises so much like awareness to how much work we still have to do. And it also raises the question of, does this country ever vision itself in a place where we're able to truly liberate ourselves and to think of our people, of our citizens, of our neighbor? Like, can we really uphold patriotism? Is that really a thing? If our students can't even be students, if our children can't even learn,
if our Black people can't even be Black,
no. If our Black people can't be Black and our Latino people can't be Latino, and our Asian people can't be Asian.
Like, and our Asian and Latino brothers and sisters can't hold anti-Blackness. It's just a lose-lose.
It's a lose-lose. And change has to come one way or the other. I wanted to touch on something that you said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about, like, why does it take the pandemic for us to begin realizing that we need affordable housing and all these things? And something that I just wanted to add to that is that affordable housing and all that would have never even been brought on the radar in the first place, but because an infectious disease, right, has no boundaries,
mm-hmm.
Those who are most comfortable in their suburbanized homes, in their mountain-like mansions, realize that, hey, even up here, we can't escape an infectious disease. And so at that point, it's like, oh, well, we have to now think about, like where this virus can be, you know, lying dormant, or the reservoirs that these viruses can be lying in. And of course they're in impoverished, poor communities. So if we never address the poverty or never like address the reservoir, then we can never rid the virus as a whole. So it's gonna always be a problem, it's gonna always mature, it's gonna always manifest itself, it's gonna always continue to grow and plague and prosper. So the right thing to do, the ideal thing to do, is to deal with the issue, deal with poverty head on, deal with the need for affordable housing, deal with the need for universal health care. People need access to health care. Deal with those things, and deal with education, so that way students in our elder community, and our children can grow and prosper and understand the needs of each other. Because with all this segregation and suburbanization and urbanization and redlining and mass incarceration and pre-mortality when it comes to medical mistrust and bias, it just creates this very toxic and uneasy environment where no one can help each other. And that's where we as a nation need to invest so much of our time.
This idea of investing time, I think people have to be more committed to, because this fight, especially when you start to examine all of the isms that exist, all of the systemic structures that exist that allow for these foundations to be destroyed, or setting people up on rigid foundations that are never meant to survive. When you start to look at these things, you realize that it's a global issue. Because anti-blackness and racism and how they function as structures are global issues. And if black bodies can be free, then everybody can be free. We don't look at it like that. But if black bodies can be free, then everybody has the potential, or living in that reality rather, to be free. And what's frustrating is when we look at it from top down to bottom up, there are individuals who have tapped on the idea of their oppressors, of saying, no, this is not what we need. People just need to work hard so that they can avoid these issues. And it's like, baby, whoever's lying to you really got you fucked up in the game to the point where you don't even understand how that oppressive ideology is keeping you right where you are. And how when that ideology gets out and you start talking to other people in your community, it sound good to them, which I don't understand, but it sound good to them because it's like, yeah, you got to work hard to come up and do this shit. Ain't nothing going to be handed to you. The whole world was handed to whiteness. So I don't understand why we have to sit down and have these conversations and we got to be the individuals praying on it. We got to be the individuals working four times harder to get crumbs. We have to be the individuals that are looking at how these systems all interact with each other, the intersectionality of our identities, and how we're always getting the short end of the stick, how time matters, how assessment matters, how really thinking through, how we're more regressive than we are progressive, because we don't look to those in need until those who have it are hurting. And that's essentially the problem. Like you said, you know, middle class individuals, those who are living in the suburbs, when they're hurting, it's the idea, once again, that we've talked about here on the podcast before, that when whites get the cold, when white America gets the cold, black Americans get the fucking pneumonia. It's a trickle-down effect. Whatever happens, if the elites are feeling this, if those who are elites, we'll get to that later, if those who are in the middle class are feeling it, you know those who are living in poverty are barely keeping their head above water. It's just not, what we've been doing before is just not working. And for those who are in the predicament, where they're either first-generation students or individuals who are the first of their families to do something, and the rest of their family may not been able to achieve those goals, or had the same opportunities as these individuals, or may have faced continuous setbacks, or may have been in a place of deep poverty, you know, because there are hierarchies in poverty where, like, where they live at, their school systems are completely jacked up. They never had access to food. They probably chose the underground economy in order to come up, and then that led to mass incarceration, which led to them never being able to get a job that would actually help them sustain themselves and build for their family. Like, it's a repeated cycle of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But for those who are, quote unquote, the individual who made their way out, they face survivor's guilt. Because they're the individual that is viewed as the savior, viewed as the one who's not dealing with less desirable living conditions. And I think for you and me both, we've had this feeling of feeling like we have 1 foot in 1 foot out. It is still not enough.
And that 1 foot in and 1 foot out seems like it lasts for an eternity. Because it's like, it's like constantly waiting and hoping that, okay, today is going to be the day when I'm not going to have to be reminded of my place. Or the place that white supremacy has placed me into.
Talk about it.
And just the psychological effects that has on us, on our children, it's just tenfold. It's so heavy. I actually posted a video on social media a few weeks ago of a couple of students, young adults. I'm sure they're definitely student age people, young adults who were
little humans.
Humans. They were in like a putt-putt golf place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were just fighting, like throwing stuff at the cashiers, just angry over something. And the caption said, all this over $4. And when I went to read the comments, I just read everybody attacking these children, calling them animals, thugs, they don't have any home training, all these things, right? Like, all these things that have perfect explanation that people care to read or care to listen.
Right.
What we see in that clip is just a bunch of young adults who are just frustrated with poverty and who are frustrated with always being told what to do and never being showed how to do anything of what they want to do. And so you have kids who are walking around here, like, and excuse my French, can I curse?
Of course you can.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm going to say, okay. Like these young adults are always being shown, fuck you. Who, like, I don't care about your dreams. Fuck you. Fuck your dreams. Like, do your job so that way this business doors can stay open and you can get your paycheck and go about your day. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But these children are coming into these places. Some of them don't even have jobs, so let me throw that out there. And quite a bit of them don't have jobs. Let's be honest. Quite a bit of young, especially young black men, do not have jobs. That's being honest. I see them a lot trying to find jobs. Nobody's trying to hire them. Let's have that conversation. And so we kind of see these young adults, just packing all this rage, all this frustration, because for so long, and they're so young, but they've been constantly told in the 16, 17 years that they've been alive, no, I don't got it. Or go here, go to class, don't be in the hallway, do this. But then they're conflicted because of the historic nature of their families and their ancestors. They know the trauma, right? Mm-hmm. They know the dealings with police brutality. They know the dealings when it comes with interacting with white people. They know that there's a wealth gap. They're born into knowing that there's a difference.
Right.
And so for the ones who decide that, okay, I'm going to go to school because I'm going to try to find a job, take care of my family, help out around the house. I've seen my mom, or my dad, they're either struggling or one's a single parent. you know, trying to make it, somebody has a health issue, something's going on, right? Mm-hmm. And they're trying to prosper. They're trying to make it. So they decide, you know what, let me help somebody out here, go to school, find a good job. And they go that route. They do everything correctly, right? They network. They, you know, someplace works, you know. You know, they take pictures with their white friends. They whiten out their social media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Survival.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They do all of those things because somewhere they've been conditioned that this was the way to make it.
Yep.
And then when they're done, it's graduation day, they get their degree. The harsh reality then steps back in. That you've done all these things. You've thrown down your own culture.
Yes.
To uplift another. There's a term for that, but it's not coming to mind. I should definitely know that term. So,
you're a black body. Please give yourself grace.
You know, exactly. That's enough. they're faced with the reality of that the game that is designed is not meant to make you a player. And so, being first generation, like, you know, you get so many perks, you know, to keep you there, you know, so that way retention is like kind of low, you know. So they want you to stay at these institutions. So they have these support groups or these minority focused groups, which are super important, minoritized groups, excuse me, and these groups help to like uplift and inspire, you know, like black and brown children, black and brown students. But ultimately, when it all falls down, you're left at being exactly what you were before you walked in that space.
Mm-hmm.
A black body.
Mm.
Yeah, you're educated at some of the world's most top universities, but because you're a black body, you can't even reap the benefits of the education that these institutions pride themselves on.
Right.
So is it truly the institutions? Is it truly what we've come there to learn? Or is that just a way to begin separating the poor from the elite? And saying that those who can come through here are the ones who are worthy to uphold these jobs as long as they're white.
But that's exactly what it is. Because that's the same narrative that's shared even when there's black people who make it through those institutions. Me and you are both Rochesterians. For those of you who don't know what being a Rochesterian is, it's an individual who was born, raised, bred, whatever you want to speak about, in Rochester, New York. Rochester, New York is also one of the top, okay, cities for concentrated poverty. And having that poverty be a very critical factor in the health of that community. So when we look at that and being Rochesterians, making it to the University of Rochester, for you to be a black body, attend the Rochester City School District, which has been in the news multiple times for their graduation rates, then make it out of the Rochester City School District to go to one of the top universities in the world. In the world, Craig, in the world.
In a word.
Which is internationally known for their science and their engineering programs. Come on. It almost seems like if you make it through here, you're a good noodle. Because of the rigor that comes with this school, right? because like you're an anomaly, so to speak, to even make it that far, because a black body from the Rochester City School District wasn't supposed to make it through the University of Rochester. We've seen that in our class. Most of our class, like our cohort of 2017, did not consist of people from Rochester, New York. It was heavy on the international students. It was heavy on students from the city. We had to play a lot of catching up being students at that university. So with that being said, it is set up that way. It is very conditional, you know, and we look at that in terms of not only our experience and how people are ranked, but when we go to these jobs and they read our resume and say, oh, you went to this school? I mean, it don't get the Yale or the Harvard, you know, but it damn sure get the U of R. You understand what I'm saying?
Nice.
Right. Oh, wow. What did you take up? Do you know this individual? Do you know this individual? Like,
I will say the sciences. It's like, oh, the sciences.
The sciences. Do you know this professor? Does this individual still work there? And oftentimes those conversations become very white because the mm-hmm. people that they're asking, do you have connections to, are people you possibly don't know, or you do know, or your nose is turned up to who these professors are. It's survival. I mean, I think for many of the black bodies who have gone through the University of Rochester or any prestigious university, for the most part, for those who really understand what it is, they knew that it was an experience that was bittersweet. What we appreciated about it is the community of the network of the black people we knew and who helped us survive through it all. But in a same sense, we also carry this sense of pride. Because it's like, oh, I'm an alum of this. Oh, I went here. You know, we often tie that to our worth. We tie education to our worth because it's been embedded in us. And that's how elitism comes in. Because now you're aligning your worth to white systems, white ladders of social mobility that don't necessarily operate the same for black lives.
So how do we foster like a mentorship type of like approach, or like just a support approach for younger people or even older people who are considering still pursuing higher education in this climate?
I think it first starts with being able to have a discussion, right? Because everybody has a different reason why they're going to school. There are individuals who are 80 right now getting degrees. There are individuals who are starting and they're in their late 20s or in their late 30s and decided that they wanted to pursue a bachelor's. And they're going to need support. We needed support. You don't only need to be able to survive your classes. You got to survive the systems that exist at your university. You got to understand the politics of the school. You got to understand what you want to do afterwards and how that aligns with your finances, your personal goals, and your values. And I think I want to be very clear on this, right? Sometimes when we look at mentorship, we ask people who are still in the process of trying to figure some shit out to mentor other people. And when you mentor people, there's no problem giving advice and leaning in on people and having these people lean into you the same. But sometimes we ask those who are not there yet, who feel already depleted, who feel beat down, who need to work out some shit for themselves to mentor. And they don't have a lot to give other than maybe a conversation or maybe some advice, because you may ask them, well, what are you doing now? And that question erupts a whole emotional fucking disaster that you feel because you're not able to say, well, what I can say is my expectations are not where I thought I would be.
so creating a space of truth, of truthy beingness, where people can be honest about the road ahead, especially being Black and brown, because our road ahead is always so unpredictable. It's so unstable. I think, like, no matter how successful we can be, we'll still always deal with that fear of losing all that we've obtained, because America has shown us historically that nothing that we strive for, build, can be sustainable without their destruction, i.e. they're either blatant, like, disruption, or their removal of it through firing, through discriminatory job practices, and through just a tumultuous journey of, like, of just inequality across the entire board.
I really love that you said that. You know, to piggyback off that, I think it's always important to leave with action items or advice to those who are first gens. And we talk about our experiences all the time, a lot of it which is tied to the fact that we are still working towards the goals we want. We have not reached our peak yet, and we damn sure are further than our experiences where we were at the bottom. But giving pointers are important. And so for those who are entering the journey of, maybe you're starting your first semester, maybe you're a junior and you're trying to figure out how to, you know, get your coins and shit in order, my biggest piece of advice for first generation students is, write down your goals, visualize your goals, and figure out a support system to help you through that, number one. And number two, if you have not done so already, begin the steps to make sure that if you got good credit, you keep good credit. And if you ain't got good credit, you're in the works to repair it. Because in the real world, it's very hard to operate when you are entering fucking 10 steps behind, due to not having your coins together, being a Black body, and all that comes with that, having not so desirable credit scores, story of my life, and really feeling frustrated over not feeling like you're where you need to be.
In addition, like, I think that it's also important to like let first generation students know that, you know, it may take more than 4 years to get their degree, and that's okay. If it takes you 6 years, do what you gotta do. If you have to work a full time or part time job while taking just 12 credit hours to maintain your financial aid, do that. Like, don't take 20 credit hours because it's the school culture, it's the climate. Take 12 credit hours and still and pick up a job and save that money. Save it. Because once that graduation comes, you would have saved up a good chunk of change to make more choices and to move more consciously after having graduated.
Talk about it.
Like, I wish I worked, like, you know, so much during my undergraduate career.
Yep. And when we got our student refund checks, we could have put that money into a high yield savings and stack with that over time. Because Lord knows, after we graduated, we was sitting there like, you good? I'm all right. I don't really know how I'm feeling today. I'm broke. You know?
Girl, whenever you seen one of our faces, like, we all would walk past each other in the hallways or in the pit. And you just already knew what we all were, what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
We were either dealing with institutional racism, dealing with, like, a professor who was perpetuating some racist ideology. Dealing with poverty.
Yes.
Dealing with financial aid, not being able to help us. And so we were, like, on our way out of the school as a whole. you know what I mean?
Because, right.
Like, you know, $65,000 a year is a lot of money.
Yep.
You know, like, a first generation student person from a poor socioeconomic status may never see $60,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, especially if the average income from a poor family in Rochester is less than $20,000.
Talk about
it. They're not seeing $60,000.
What is 60?
What is 60? Like, what?
Right.
Like, and if I did see $60,000, and that was the only time I'm going to see $60,000, it damn sure ain't going to no tuition.
Okay.
come on. And something else that I want to say is that you have to be willing. Now, I really want first-generation students to take heed to this message right here. You have to be willing to sacrifice. Because we come from a poor socioeconomic background, that you have to be willing to... You have to be willing to understand that there's gonna be days where you're just gonna look a mess.
Mm-hmm.
You may not can't, you know, like, and this is the autumn out, like, you know, fellas out here, you probably can't go and get a brush cut, you know. you can't go and, you know, get a Caesar, you know, where it faded on the sides, you feel me?
Period.
Like, you know, you can't, you know, go and cop, you know, the latest J's.
Or to the party with the latest fit.
Or go to the party with the latest fit. And for all of my mallet ladies, you probably can't go in, you know, and you know, to the salon.
Shout out to Giv.
Or, you know, get your nails done, you know, getting a full set, you know, in a petty, that's a lot of money.
It
you
is.
You know, like, so those things are things that we got to think about, like, to help us get through that hump.
Mm-hmm.
And that advice, you know, is so important for every part of life, because college is just one part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's so many other journeys that's going to come in life after buying your first home, or
yep,
buying your first car, or buying your first family pet. Like, all of those things take some type of sacrifice, like, some types of things. And again, I just think it's totally important that first-generation students just remember that life is all about sacrificing. And it being, and it, like, and as a Black man, and as a Black queer man, I can say undoubtedly that my life has been about nothing but sacrifice. This past year, I've attended a post-baccalaureate program because my ultimate career goal is to be in medicine. I wanted to improve my chances of gaining acceptance into medical school, so I attended a post-bac program. Considering my journey, I didn't have much financial aid available left to take the remainder post-bac coursework. So that involved me, before this program, saving up at least $12,000 of my salary, of my paycheck. Saving my entire paychecks because I knew that I was going to have to pay for my classwork. And so, like, for us, we have to remember that sometimes it's going to take us doing that. Is it fair? Hell nah. And it is not right. But because we're, you know, trying to undo so much damage that has been done to our communities by, you know, the system, it's taken us to be creative to reach our goals. And in being creative, sometimes you have to, you know, you have to swallow your pride and say that I'm not gonna take that trip to Cancun. I'm not gonna go to Punta Cana next week. Or I'm not going to go to Puerto Rico, though the flights are cheap. You know what I mean? Like, it's always looking at the bigger picture. And also that means finding other ways to have fun, finding ways to have fun that's free, that's cost effective. Can you have a night out with your girls and not spend $20 or just spend only $20? Like, how can we be that creative and still be on a budget and still look good? And trust me, there are so many ways to make that happen. You just have to be mindful. And I know it's stressful being mindful, but we've endured enough stress that we can endure that.
Ooh, we can endure that. And this is why Broke Bug Bougie is so important, because, like, you wanna look good for the low low. You know, you need to ask another woman who's maneuvering through Brokeland, or a brother who's maneuvering through Brokeland, how they do it. Because there are people out here who can make broke look good, okay? And still be able to reach their goals. And those sacrifices are crucial, all right, to us being able to survive. And eventually we will get to a point where we are living and thriving versus living and surviving. But it takes time, it takes community, it takes recognizing truth and how this society shit is just set up. It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Totally is. And it's whack as fuck.
Period.
And that ain't it.
It just ain't it. Dr. Bell, I want to thank you so much for always chiming in. I feel like we have such important conversations. This is filled with love and contemplating on how to liberate our communities and how to be support systems for one another. Sometimes for those of y'all who may be unfamiliar with my love for Dr. Bell, like, we be on the phone sometimes an hour, 2 hour, 3 hours, four. I think the maximum we did was like a shift, a day shift, a 6 hour day, talking to each other just about real ass life. And the community is important. The community around you exists. It's here. Typically, we would do To Catch a Coin, but this episode talks about finances, gives people pointers and advice, especially for first generation students. So therefore, the To Catch a Coin segment is cut from this episode. And I want to thank you all for tuning in to the Broke Black Bougie podcast. And we'll be in your ear soon.
Now go and save some money.
Period.